203-WICC. That's 203-333-9422 or toll free at 1-800-922-6060.
Welcome back to This Week. Ann Carrick and Vincent Caprio in the studio right here at WICC 600 on the phone. Phil Mortensen, a partner at Barton, Barton & Plotkin. How are you, Phil?
I'm well, thank you, Ann. How are you?
Good, and I understand you have escaped the Snowmageddon, too.
I've escaped the snow, but I don't know what it's going to be like trying to get back in.
When are you trying to fly back?
Well, I was flying back Thursday night, but I may be flying back tomorrow. I just don't know yet.
Oh, no, you're not flying back tomorrow. I can tell you that already.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
I don't know what you think you want to do, but you're not coming back tomorrow. It's not happening.
So I understand.
Yeah, so just enjoy it there where you are. So, Phil, we wanted to talk to you to get a little update. I know I haven't spoken to you in ages about overall trends and changes with unions and business, or if maybe there aren't any, and also how the economy and a change in the White House, you know, may or may not have affected that and attitudes and all those good things. So do you have an area you'd like to start, or should I just ask you a question?
Just fire away.
Well, let's start with, you know, overall, have you seen a trend or change with unions?
I think we're seeing a trend right now, in particular with the Labor Board, the National Labor Relations Board in Washington. Since President Obama became president, and he's now gone, basically the NLRB has gone from being a Republican Bush board to now a decidedly Obama Democrat board, and they're making a lot of changes.
More
to come.
Yeah, but what kind of change is that where people might notice those changes?
They're reversing a lot of the decisions from the prior board, which was by the Bush board, and they're becoming very much more pro-labor. They would say pro-employee, but I say pro-labor. And I think I'll go even a step further. If anybody's been following it the last couple of years, there was an act introduced in both the House and the Senate called the Employee Free Choice Act, which never would get off the ground in the Senate, and now that the Republicans have taken control of the House, it's just not going to go, in my opinion. However, the new Labor Board is going to probably, through either rulemaking or decision-making, probably implement some of the things that were in the Employee Free Choice Act, which is really a pro-labor, pro-organizing type law.
Well, I remember you mentioning the Employee Free Choice and saying that the name was very misleading because it really was sort of lack of choice.
It was lack of choice. It was pro-labor, not necessarily pro-employee. It basically was encouraging employees to get bushwhacked into signing up with a union, and then there would be no election under the card check part of it. I don't see card check coming into being. They really would need to change the law for that. But some of the things I could see happening with the new labor board would be they might push for, like, quickie elections. Currently, the median time from filing of a petition for an election is the time of the actual election itself is about 42 days. I could see the labor board, either by decision or rulemaking, changing that to, let's say, maybe 2 weeks. They'd have to change a few other things, but it could be done. In 2 weeks, I don't think the employees are going to get to hear both sides of the story to make an educated, informed decision.
Right. I just wanted to clarify, in case people listening aren't sure what you're talking about, is that if you're at a company that does not have a union and a union is presenting itself as an option, what you're talking about, the election, is when the employees actually elect or vote whether they want the union or they don't want the union, correct? That's what you're talking about.
The time from filing a petition to the time of the election is about 6 weeks.
Right, and so right now there's about 6 weeks, and during that time both the union and the company are supposed to sort of present their case so that the employees can make a decision as to which way they want to go. And what you're saying is the change that could be coming might shorten that to 2 weeks, which would be really tough for both sides to have a good case put together to present to anybody.
Well, not really tough for the union side, because the union side has gotten these people signed up, in many cases, without the employer knowing anything about it, and therefore without the employer being able to come back and say, okay, here's the flip side of the coin. You're hearing all the alleged positive things about having a union. Here are some things you may want to think about. And this would give, in effect, the employees 2 weeks to hear from the employer some of the negative things about having a union.
Right. Have you seen any attitude changes by workers or employees, or I'm not sure whether you, because I know you work more with the companies than the individuals, but, you know, whether they're more for or against unions based on, like, the change in the economy?
I don't think I've seen any change as far as employees, but you're right. I work solely with companies, but I don't think I've seen a perceived any kind of perception of a change among the employees. You know, bear in mind that the current, you know, the makeup of the workforce in this country, the private sector, excluding the public sector employees, private sector is somewhere between 7 and 8% unions. That's like one out of maybe every 14 workers in the country in the private sector is a member of a union, as compared to maybe 35% in the 50s. So unions are not really prevalent very much in this country. There are still markets, like New York City, for example, or Chicago to a little bit less extent, maybe L.A., where unions are still very strong and prevalent, but nationwide, they're just not around that much, and that, yeah, that's a sign that employees, for the most part, have not seen the positive side of having a union represent them.
Because there's 15 million people in the country that are in unions, and it's only 12%, where 30 years ago, it was 20 million people. Do you know what, at the height of unions in the 50s, what percentage were in the unions at that point?
It was about, somewhere around, and give or take a couple, somewhere around 35% were in unions.
In the 50s.
And back in those days, the vast majority was private sector, because a lot of public sector employees did not have the right to unionize back in those days.
Right. And the other, you know, so when people hear the word union, a lot of people that are sophisticated now think of teachers. The highest percentage of people that are in unions are actually in teachers. It's 38%.
Yeah, teachers, police, firefighters.
Right.
And
government positions, yeah.
A whole different situation.
Yeah.
But what's interesting, the private sector and public sector are about the same amount. It's 7.5 million employees each in the private and public sector. But the private sector is 10 times larger, the amount of people in the private sector, even though they both have the same amounts of people in the pool.
I didn't understand what you just said.
Phil articulated a few minutes ago. It's actually the same amount, but the private sector has 10 times more people doing the same jobs that are in the union. There's a small percentage of people in the union.
Well, that's what he's saying, like 7% or something in the private sector versus, what did you say, 35% in the public sector?
Well, no, I'm saying in the 50s.
In the 50s,
overall,
I'm sorry.
35%, but that was virtually all private sector employees.
Right.
Today, the combined percent is, I think, around 12%,
yes,
perhaps.
Oh, okay.
Of which 7% is private sector, and obviously the public sector is a lot higher prevalence of being union.
Because remember, the technology companies in the late 50s and early 60s were the first companies to say, we don't want unionized employees. And as their percentage got higher, their percentage of union workers got lower and lower. Right?
As we turn more from a manufacturing economy to a service economy, you'd see a lot less union.
Right. So, like,
and is manufacturing where most of the union employees in the public sector, is that still where they are for the most part?
Well, no, you're starting to get in the service area. For example, probably the most successful union today is the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, which was headed up by Andy Stern until he retired a little while ago. They're one of the most prevalent, one of the most aggressive, and also one of the most successful unions in organizing. And it seems like they're almost carving out a niche in organizing minimum wage and low-paid hourly workers.
And in all industries, or are they in certain industries more so?
Well, I can't say for sure, but for example, I know they've been very successful in the hotel hospitality industry. You know, where the housekeepers, the porters, et cetera, in hotels.
Oh, okay.
And office workers, obviously.
And in following up what he said, New York State is number one, 25%, and North Carolina is number 50, at 3% of union workers. And it's not, so when you see companies relocating North Carolina, when the CEO makes the decision to do that, that's one of the reasons.
Well, part of the reasons they're going to leave the union behind.
Right. Exactly. Right, Phil?
Yes, they can go for lower labor costs overall.
So, Phil, I mean, why is it that unions are still, I was going to say, have more of a stronghold in larger cities like New York and Chicago? I mean, is it just because they've been there so long?
I think it's because they've been there so long. They still have, like, take the construction industry in New York. They still have pretty much a stranglehold. You can still build non-union in New York City, but it's very difficult.
Well, I mean, and I know, you know, being on the outskirts of New York, people joke all the time about you know, oh, if you're doing this in New York, well, you'd have to, you know, have a union person for the light bulb and another union person for the ladder, and then a different union for, like, there's like nobody can do anything because of all the union rules. I mean, it's sort of like a running joke. I'm hoping it's not quite as bad as the joke, but I'm thinking, is it because the people in New York have grown up with the unions were always there, and so it's like they're, you know, if you grew up with everybody you knew worked in the union, you figure that's just how it's supposed to be.
It can be a generational thing, and you would have seen the same thing and go back maybe 30 years in the Pittsburgh area where Bethlehem Steel was still strong, U.S. Steel was still strong, they were a union, and you had generation after generation working in the union mills, steel mills, and there was a disincentive to go to college because you could do better working in a steel mill. There was job security. That's all gone.
Well, yeah, but that's definitely gone.
Generational type thing.
Sure.
Let's talk about the teachers' unions. So Governor Christie in New Jersey had asked the teachers' unions to take a 0% increase, even though contractually they were at 4%. And most people know that in the private sector, since September 2008 and this recession started, most people that work for corporations have not gotten a raise.
A lot of them got salary cuts rather than lay people off.
Right.
They reduced everybody's
pay. But no one's getting 4%. So these teachers' unions still get 4%. Christie said, why can't you get 1%? And, of course, he has been vilified by the teachers' union. Any comment on that, Phil?
Well, last spring I was driving through New Jersey listening to a radio talk show about this very subject, and the two radio commentators, much like I won't pick on your politics or even claim to know your politics, but these two radio commentators on this New Jersey station were, let's say, to the right of the center, and people were calling in, and teachers calling in were just vilifying the governor, as you said, for this whole thing. And this one commentator on the radio was saying, well, if the pie is only so big, there's only so much that can go around, and therefore, what are you going to do? And one teacher called in and said, I don't care. There's a contract. The contract says I'm supposed to get this money, and I contractually have to get this money. And the response was, you're too stupid to be a teacher.
Oh.
Yeah. But, and I think Christie's looking at it the right way. And he's not the only one. There's a lot of governors around the country that are looking at it and saying, and by the way, I think the blame is being misplaced somewhat, but they're saying we're going to change the laws regarding the powers of unions for public sector employees because this has got out of hand, because we've got governments, all state governments around the country, that are getting close to going bankrupt, or at least they're in very tough financial straits, making tough decisions. I don't blame the union so much. I blame the government as much, because it was the government that said to the unions, when the union said, I want X, the government said, okay, you can have it.
Yeah.
It's same with the auto companies that got into such a jam, blaming the unions. Well, somebody gave it to them. The union's job was to get as much as they could from management, and management's job was to put the brakes on. Well, in the auto industry, they didn't put the brakes on, even though they make brakes.
Right. And so, in other words, what you're saying is some of these, we're picking on the auto industry and education, but some of these things should have been discussed the last time they were negotiating and said, hey, we're not going to be able to do this anymore.
Or several contracts ago.
Yeah.
And you see, I see more of it in the public sector than I saw in the private sector, because this sounds terrible, but in the public sector, you have some people just were not safeguarding the public dollars, whereas in the private sector, you've got the profit motive. So that's why, sure, the auto industry went at it. But the auto industry, they went out of control because, you know, until the strong Japanese companies came into our country with their cars, you know, the big three, they had control of the sale of cars in this country, so they could keep giving away because they could pass it on to the consumer.
Right, until somebody came along and offered a car for less, or that was better, or whatever.
A better car for less.
A competitive alternative,
but
exactly.
Auto factories in North Carolina and Alabama that don't have union workers, from Honda and Toyota, and the top union worker in the big three was making $70 an hour, where those non-union workers were making 20.
Right. So what are some of the future trends, as the way you see it, Phil, as far as unions and business? I mean, how's the dance going to change going forward?
Well, I think in the short term, you're going to see, again, with the labor board being much more pro-labor, they're going to make it a little bit easier. Well, they're going to make it a lot easier, but how good the unions are going to be, I don't know. Make it easier for the unions to organize, and I think the unions, if they're smart, will take advantage of that now. We don't know who the next president's going to be, whether Obama's going to make it for another 4 years. We don't know what's going to happen in the 2012 elections as far as Congress. So I think the unions, if they're smart, are going to be as active as possible now to, you know, make hay while you can.
Right. I assume it's much harder to get rid of a union than to prevent it.
Absolutely.
Like if a union comes in and then the union members, you know, sit there and say, well, this isn't better. We don't really like this. You know, it's not like they can just take another vote and say, okay, the union's done.
No, by law, if a union comes in and is certified by the labor board, the union has a year to do as best it can to get a contract. And for that whole period of time, the employees cannot ditch the union. They can't even file a petition to decertify the union. Once the union gets a contract, the employees are barred for the term of the contract, up to 3 years, from filing a petition to decertify. So there are unions that will get in, negotiate. They're not getting what they thought they were going to get, but they see that year expiring, and they cave into whatever the company wants to lock in the employees for 3 more years. And nothing the employees can do about it.
So once they've been certified by the board, they're around for the next 4 years one way or another.
Probably, yeah.
They want the year to get it contract done, and then the 3 years that follow. So, you know, give or take, you've probably got 4 more years that the employees are sort of stuck with whatever that deal is, whether they liked it or not.
Yeah, I've been in so many situations, Ann, where you get in there, you're negotiating a contract, and the employees go to the employer on a first contract. The employees go to the employer and just say, but we didn't realize we were going to not get this or that we were going to lose this. And the employer says, we told you. You just didn't listen.
And at that point, it's already too late. They can't. The employer can't even do anything about it for them.
Not for the first year. And again, if the union gives the employer the contract the employer wants, and stuff for the employer to turn that down, then they're locked out for that period of time too.
So in those situations, you know, what is the best? We'll take it from two standpoints. From the company's standpoint, what's the best thing for them to do if a union is kind of talking to their people, you know, to make sure that the employees are getting a full picture before they make a decision? And what if let's say I'm an employee somewhere and a union is trying to come into where I work, what are the questions I should be asking to know which way I want to vote?
Well, the employee should be asking the union, for example, what's this going to cost me in dollars and cents, because unions are a business, they don't operate for free, so you got things like dues, initiation fees, possible fines, possible assessments. They should be asking the union, what legal obligations would I have to the union if I became a union member, and all unions have what's called a constitution or something like it, and the locals have bylaws. I'm working on a case now with the Teamsters. Their constitution is like 232 pages of rules. So the employee should say, what are these rules? How binding? And by the way, if you become a union member, the constitution and bylaws of that union become a contractual relationship between you and the union, enforceable in a court of law. So if you don't abide by that contract, the constitution, the union can take you to court. And then I'd ask the union, what kind of guarantees are there that you're going to get me what you say you're going to get my vote? And the answer to that is none.
They can't guarantee because they haven't negotiated a contract yet.
Right. I mean, you know, it's kind of interesting. The law allows the union to promise things to employees because the NLRB says, obviously, the employees know that the union doesn't sign the paycheck. Yet the employer, of course, is forbidden from promising anything to the employees. And employees have to need to know, must know, what happens if the union can't get a deal that they want and they call the employees out on a strike. What are the legal rights of the company? What are the legal rights of the employees? A lot of employees don't realize it. A company has a right to legally keep operating in the event of an economic strike, which means the company can go out and hire brand new people as permanent replacements.
Right.
So these are things that people need to think about, and I think an employer has an obligation to advise the employees because the employees are only getting the rosy picture on the other side.
Exactly.
With these state crises, with these unfunded liabilities, is there going to be a trend in the future to offer pensions that are less to people in unions?
Oh, I think so. I'm dealing with a client that has, unfortunately, is in a multi-employer plan that the plan assets are about $150 million and the vested benefits are $850 million. So you got a plan that's $700 million in the red, mm-hmm. and obviously you can't go on like that. So I think what you're going to find going forward are employers trying to get out of these multi-employer plans with unions and getting into more secure plans, let's face it, the benefits are not going to be as good because the rosy days are gone.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm often reminded of friends I had who worked for Pan Am and Eastern. We know how that went.
Right.
You know, sure. when the company went down, all of those promised pensions and benefits and retirement plans and everything that was all part of the union contract, they were just gone.
It was worth nothing.
Nothing. Right. No, but I mean, it didn't matter what they negotiated because the company went under. It was over, you know.
That's why in 1974 we got the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, because there were so many people that worked for a company. I'm not just saying union, any kind of company. Worked for a company for 40 years back in those days. People did that stuff.
Right.
And they had this great pension plan that they worked for. They earned. It was theirs. And it was vested. But it wasn't there when they retired.
Right. The money just wasn't there. Yeah.
Enron.
Yeah, there.
Oh, sure. People lost all their pensions there.
Yeah.
Sure.
Absolutely. Well, you know, when a whole company goes under, it doesn't matter what the plan or the deal was. It's gone.
Exactly.
There's nothing, there's no legal, you can't get money out of something.
Saying, I've got a contractual right to that. Well, it's not there.
Right.
It's not there. And it's a shame. It really is a shame.
I mean, the auto workers of GM got a really good deal. The stockholders didn't.
No.
Right. What percentage of GM do the union workers own?
I'm not sure what that is.
I don't know the answer to that one.
No, I've just seen it debated that people have said that they, lawyers that are from friends with, have told me they got the best deal that any union ever got of a company that went bankrupt.
It could be. Well, Phil, I know that you're busy out there, so thanks for the update on the unions. Any parting words that something we didn't cover?
No, enjoy your ride home tonight in the snow.
Yeah, no snowflakes yet. We're waiting.
No, none yet? Okay, good.
You know, it has not arrived yet. I think the from everything I've been watching and looking at, it's much later, like after 10 tonight is when it's probably really going to start to snow, and really 1 a.m. until, say, 7 a.m. is going to be the really heavy, nasty snow.
For the morning rush.
There'll be no morning rush.
I always enjoy being on your show, and hopefully I didn't annoy too many people listening out there.
I don't think so. And I didn't invite them to call, although they were welcome to, but next time I'll be sure to tell them that ahead of time. They'll be waiting for you that way.
Okay, and I'll stay in California.
Thanks, Phil.
Hey, have a safe trip back, and thank you, Phil.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We're going to talk to Phil Lippel about...